Marketplace is supported by Epson, workforce all-in-one printers for business powered by Precision Core Technology, workforce printers for home offices, small offices, and network work groups. Epson.com.
Coming up on the program today, Etsy gets all, I don't know, corporate on us, I guess. Life on a rice farm in Manchuria, and also from the oil trading pit, something called Super Contango. Boy, I love that phrase. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact. With the email and online marketing tools small businesses and nonprofits need to promote their organizations. Learn more at ConstantContact.com. And by Progressive Insurance, with its Apron Project, celebrating progress and the people who make it happen. And by T. Rowe Price. In today's uncertain markets, institutions, advisors, and individuals choose T. Rowe Price to find global investment opportunities. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence.
In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday, the fifth day of March. Great, as always, to have you with us. We will begin today at that curious intersection of big business and crocheted cat beds. We get there by way of Etsy, the Brooklyn-based online marketplace for the aforementioned cat beds, and much, much more, it should, in all fairness, be said. The company filed for an initial public offering today, looking to raise about $100 million in the process, valuing itself at about $1.7 billion, which is, by any measure that I can think of, very big business indeed. So how do you suppose the idea of going to the capital markets is going to go over with cat bed crocheters? Gigi Duban starts us off.
People say timing is everything. High-profile online retailers like Zulily and Wayfair had solid debuts with their IPOs in 2014. That could be good news for Etsy, says Mark Brohan, VP of Research for Internet Retailer Magazine.
There's a good appetite for these kinds of things. That's why these IPOs have done pretty well.
Plus, there aren't that many places you can buy handmade leg warmers or crafted bohemian headbands. Etsy has made itself that place. William Salmon, professor at Harvard Business School, is intimately familiar with Etsy.
Oh, I've bought ties. I've bought belts with fish patterns. I bought a number of things.
He says Etsy fulfills that craving customers have for something different. Etsy's mission has been to change the way things are made and sold. That socially minded philosophy doesn't have to go away when the company goes public, Salmon says. Just look at Ben and Jerry's.
They were able to go public and still maintain a sense with their customers that they were different.
Steve Kaplan teaches entrepreneurship at the University of Chicago. He says there might be some initial rumblings when the company goes public, but people will soon get over it.
If you deliver something that your customers really like, you have created a huge amount of social value.
And as long as glitter paper garlands make people happy, those sellers will keep making them. I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
All right, let's do a little bit of compare and contrast here for a minute, all right? In a speech to the National People's Congress in Beijing today, Chinese Premier Li Keqiang announced a new growth target for the world's second biggest economy, 7%, which would be the lowest growth rate there since a brief dip back in 1990. Compare that, just for instance, to the U.S., where growth last year was a bit shy of 2.5%. So, to compare and contrast, what do you suppose that kind of expansion here would look or feel like? We asked Marketplace's Amy Scott to find out.
The last time the United States economy saw anything like 7% growth was 1983, when we came out of two severe back-to-back recessions.
China's really been extraordinary in sustaining those sorts of rates of growth, well, actually over 10% for long periods of time. You don't find many countries that have done that.
Dean Baker co-directs the Center for Economic and Policy Research. China's rapid growth comes as it changes from an agrarian society to a modern industrial one. The U.S. went through that a long time ago. So could we grow like that today?
We could all go out and have a lot of babies, but that's just not going to happen.
Lakshman Achithan is co-founder of the Economic Cycle Research Institute. He says more babies would eventually lead to more workers making and spending money.
The other place to look would be productivity growth.
But productivity growth was actually negative last year. Then there's the question of whether we would even want 7% growth. Carrie Leahy with Decision Economics says sure, for a while.
I don't think the economy could sustain that growth rate for probably more than about 18 months to 2 years without generating some inflation problems.
Not to mention potential environmental risks. Others say GDP is the wrong number to focus on. Zachary Carabel is a strategist with the financial services firm InvestNet.
You know, you could have really strong GDP numbers and really bad employment numbers. So we have to be really careful about using GDP as some sort of lodestar of are we doing well, are we doing badly.
It takes more than growth for everyone to do well. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Things went reasonably well on Wall Street. Today we'll have the details when we do the numbers. There was some reassuring, I guess you could say, news from the Federal Reserve about the banking industry today. The Fed says all 31 big banks that it had subjected to another round of stress tests, that is, how those banks would do in another financial crisis, all 31 of them passed, which has not always been the case. The tests were run by the Fed proper, that is, the head office in Washington, which has gradually been taking back a whole lot of the power, banking regulations-wise, that the New York Fed had assumed. John Hilsenrath is the chief economics correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. His front page story in the paper today is all about that changing balance of Fed power from New York down to Washington. John, good to have you with us.
Great to be here.
How did it used to be? How did the Federal Reserve Bank of New York and the Fed in Washington, how did that relationship used to work?
Well, the relationship has evolved over time. If you go back to the Great Depression era, the New York Fed still had a lot of influence over the oversight of banks and in particular the oversight of Wall Street. Well, that changed after the financial crisis. Washington, as we document in the paper today, felt that New York had failed and the way they had been doing oversight of the banks hadn't been working more broadly. And so they restructured the whole system.
And it came in the person, this member of the Fed Board of Governors named Daniel Tarullo, with whom you spoke, who, with the assent of Ben Bernanke, the former chairman, basically said, right. You know what, we're going to start doing things out of Washington now.
Well, so there's a long history here. Even before Tarullo came along, there had been friction and tensions in the past between the New York bank examiners and the Washington bank examiners. And there had been efforts by Fed governors in the past to centralize more oversight in D.C., and New York had fended them off. But after the financial crisis, Tarullo came along with Ben Bernanke's assent and said, basically, you know, we're going to do it a new way. And what they did was they created a committee in Washington called the Large Institution Supervision Coordinating Committee.
Yeah.
And now the biggest banks in the United States, not just banks, but also some other financial institutions, are overseen out of this central committee in Washington, D.C. New York still plays a role,
yeah,
but the shots are getting called in Washington, D.C.
Give me a real-life example of how this change has worked in practice. And one of the things you mentioned in your story is the London Whale and J.P. Morgan losing $6 billion.
Right.
Daniel Tarullo gets on the phone with regulators and says, in essence, what the heck were you people doing?
What happened here? Yeah. There was an even hotter incident. Very early on, he came in like a bull in a china shop, really wanting to shake the place up. There were debates in late 2009 when Citigroup wanted to pay back its rescue money that right. it got from the U.S. government. And there was an intense debate at the Fed about how much capital it should be expected to raise in public markets and basically be free of government involvement in its capital base. And Tarullo really pushed the New York Fed examiners very hard. And in essence, he said, we're sick and tired of cleaning up these messes. You have to demand that they raise more capital.
One assumes that Janet Yellen is in support of all this.
It looks that way. Janet Yellen she wasn't the person who put this process in motion, but in many ways, she's following the path that Ben Bernanke, her predecessor, set out. And certainly in the case of supervision, that seems to be the case. She actually gave a speech in New York on Tuesday in which for the first time she talked about this new committee and this new structure in place. And she made an argument that Dan Tarullo has made, which is that by having this new committee in Washington, they feel this is a really important part of what they're doing. They can look across the whole system, that they used to do things in silos, that the Citigroup bank examination team would just focus on Citigroup, and that the Wells Fargo examination team in San Francisco would just focus on Wells, and that they didn't see problems that were bubbling up across the whole system. So they feel like this new process actually puts them in a position where they could see problems as they bubble up across the financial system. The problem with that argument is that you will never be able to say it works, but at some point, if there's another crisis, you could say that it didn't work.
John Hilsenrath is the chief economics correspondent at The Wall Street Journal. John, thanks very much for your time.
Great. Thank you.
Coming up.
The neighboring villages have names like Mudtown and the Dunes and Lonely Outpost.
Says the guy who spent 3 years in a place called Wasteland. Seriously. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 38 points today, 0.2%, closed at 18,135. The NASDAQ up 15 points, about a 3%, 49.82 at the bell. The S&P 500 up 2 points, 0.1%, finished at 2101. Costco piled up 2.7% today. That after announcing better-than-expected quarterly profits. The nation's biggest supermarket operator, that would be Kroger, in case you didn't know, climbed 6.2% after its profits beat expectations. Shopping mall operator Simon Property Group traded down 0.2% today. There are reports its approach rival Macerich about a possible merger. Macerich moved up 5% today. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note thus fell. The number, the yield that you're looking for is 2.11%. You're looking at listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by PayScale, modern compensation software that helps job seekers know what they're worth and employers pay the right way. More at PayScale.com. And by Epson, with workforce all-in-one printers for business powered by Precision Core Technology. With a full line of workforce printers for home offices, small offices, and networked work groups. Epson.com. And by RingCentral, the cloud communication system that integrates with CRM, sales and support applications like Salesforce, Zendesk, Box, and now Google for Work. More at RingCentral.com. When you're not near a radio, listen to Marketplace on your cell phone or tablet. You can hear us on Slacker, Stitcher, SoundCloud, Flipboard, and more, or download our iPhone app. Find the option that's best for you at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Labor Department issues the February jobs report. The Federal Reserve is scheduled to report consumer credit data for January. And the International Festival of Owls gets underway in Houston, Minnesota. Who attends? Kids and adults, and of course, owls. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. If you wanted to buy a barrel of oil today, it'd cost you a bit more than $50. But if you wanted to buy a barrel of oil for September delivery, it'd cost you something like $55. That's a situation, namely where the future price is higher than the spot price, for which traders have a special name. It's called contango. Basically, the idea that there is so much oil in the market right now, you have to give a price discount if you want to get rid of it sooner. Crazy, right? But according to analysts at Credit Suisse today, we could soon be in store for something much stranger yet, super contango. Marketplace's Stan Alcorn explains what that is.
To get the technical definition of a super contango, I turn to the author of that Credit Suisse note, global energy economist Jan Stewart.
So when you have a contango, it means that there is too much oil around. When you have a super contango, it means there is just like a freakish amount of oil.
How freakish? Energy consultant Mike Lynch suggests picturing a huge bumper crop of tomatoes.
You can't just discount the price of tomatoes and have everybody decide to eat lasagna, so you have to store them.
Freeze them for a few months, and when supplies died down or demands picked up, sell them for enough to cover your freezer costs and make some kind of profit. That would be contango. But
somebody says, well, you know, we're keeping cucumbers in these freezers and, you know, you can't have them unless you pay us another 8% on top of the usual storage fee for tomatoes.
That is the super contango situation. As we run out of space, storage costs go up, and that sends the future price through the roof. How does that work for crude oil? The people who trade it store it in giant circular tanks in places like Cushing, Oklahoma.
Most are painted white in color.
Bruce Hine is a spokesperson for Magellan Midstream Partners.
And they're large above-ground tanks that can be an average of 60 feet high.
Nobody would tell me how much oil is in their tanks, but Jan Stewart reckons nationwide they're still less than two-thirds full. So we're not at super contango yet.
We aren't at a crazy extreme yet. If nothing changes, then, I don't know, 11, 12 weeks or so, we'll get there.
Stewart says that may sound soon, but in the fast-paced world of oil trading, that's like three generations. A lot could change. I'm Stan Alcorn for Marketplace.
With an eye toward tomorrow morning's unemployment report, this item by way of setting up our next story. The Bureau of Labor Statistics says that over the next decade, the number of software developer jobs is going to grow twice as fast as any other field. Those are jobs, by the way, that average $90,000 a year. Tech companies have been scrambling to find experienced talent for a good long while now, and that scramble is only going to get more scrambly, as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
Please help our police officers. The life of a young jet-setting computer engineer.
Hey, you must be James.
Yeah, nice to meet you.
I met James Jones in the noisy lobby of the Portland airport as he came off a late-night flight from Chicago recently. He was in town for several days of training at the fast-growing software startup, it's called Puppet Labs, that is his new employer as of a couple months ago. I offered to drive him to his hotel. We ended up doing our interview in my car on the freeway.
It's definitely nice traveling.
Jones is 27, married, no kids. Got out of Northwestern University in 2009 with a psych and computer science degree and faced the Great Recession.
Definitely the economy had taken a downturn and it was a little bit rough to find jobs. It was scary there for a bit.
How long was it rough and scary?
About 3 months after graduation. I was pretty lucky. I was able to get that opportunity.
A whole 3 months until he landed a job at Hewlett-Packard, paying $50,000 and change. It was a short recession for James Jones. Since then, it's been a steady ramp up to this new technical engineering job deploying cutting-edge automation software in huge data centers all over the Midwest. Jones says the offer from Puppet Labs was very good.
Yeah, I was very satisfied. I don't want to necessarily get into specifics, but they were willing to work with me and make sure that I was happy.
The company also wouldn't give specifics, but jobs at this level typically pay in the high five to low six figures. Jones says salary isn't everything.
Because I'm kind of a hobbyist. You know, I like actually managing servers and getting a little nerdy at home. Working in the field that I love and working for a company that I respect was kind of the bigger focus for me.
Earlier in the day, I'd stopped at Puppet Labs' downtown offices to get the lay of the tech employment landscape. It's typical startup decor, three floors of open-plan industrial chic with all the amenities.
Catered breakfast on Mondays, catered lunch on Wednesdays, a silent room for napping or reading, an arcade.
Seriously, they've got Donkey Kong and Super Mario Brothers. Art Amela, the senior recruiter at the company, tells me the headcount is up to 330 spread across the U.S., Northern Ireland, and the Czech Republic. Puppet Labs had just 30 employees 5 years ago. Amela says pay and benefits are competitive with other fast-growing technology companies. Everybody gets stock options. And for top engineers with several years' experience, poaching is common.
We know they're being contacted all the time, and casually I'll check with them about how many have contacted them this week. But if we keep our employees happy, and they are happy, it's not going to be a threat.
So just how tight is this job market for people who can write complicated software and manage critical network infrastructure, or even for folks with more basic skills to develop smartphone apps and websites?
The job market is exploding, and you pair that with the ability to get job ready online, and you have something very exciting.
Ryan Carson is founder of Treehouse, a four-year-old Portland startup that teaches coding, web development, and technology marketing online. Treehouse already has more than 100,000 students across the U.S. and abroad, many without a computer science degree or prior experience, but with a strong desire to get in while the getting's good.
You can start out about $35,000 to $45,000. Then if you put in your time and you improve and you grow, you know, in 5 years, you'll be 80 to 100 plus. And I think that's going to continue.
Maybe or maybe not. The shortage of tech talent certainly is acute right now. Programs to train new IT workers are booming at universities and community colleges, trade schools, and online institutes like Treehouse. Meanwhile, IT job recruiting on college campuses will rise 50% this year. Starting salaries are up, too, to $62,000 on average, the most for any field. But keep in mind supply and demand. If too many people pour in, this could turn into a less brilliant job move a few years from now. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
We talked a bit about China's economic growth up at the top of the program. One result of all that growth is a huge transformation of the Chinese landscape. The urban environment, now increasingly glass skyscrapers and fancy new cars, but also the rural environment, where even to this day, half a billion or more Chinese still live. Up in Manchuria, in far northeast China, there is a tiny, tiny village called Wasteland. They farm rice there. Michael Meyer spent 3 years living in Wasteland. He wrote about the changes that are coming in a new book called In Manchuria. Michael, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
How did it come to pass that you wound up spending 3 years in the back of beyond Manchuria?
Carelessness, I suppose. You know, I wrote a book about Beijing, The Last Days of Old Beijing, which was about the destruction of the of historic Beijing, and I lived in the capital's oldest neighborhood, right at the foot of Tiananmen Square.
Which is, I'll say here, just to get the plug in, The Last Days of Old Beijing is a great read on the transformation of urban China. But anyway, go ahead.
Thank you. And, you know, I think it's time to write a book when the book you want to read doesn't exist. And so the Beijing book came about because I wanted to read about the transformation of urban China and whether it was a good thing or bad thing. And then next, I wanted to read a book about rural China and the changes that were happening there. And so I went northeast from Beijing. I went 600 miles. Why I chose this village is because my wife grew up in this village, and I wanted to do a book with a more personal connection.
Tell me what it looks like out there on the Manchurian plains.
It looks nothing like a wasteland. It's a fertile floodplain of the Songhua River. So if readers can, or listeners, sorry, can picture just sinking your hand in the soil and pulling up like saturated coffee grounds. They're that wet and that loamy, sort of that earthy feel to them. It's quite beautiful. It's completely flat, and the paddies run to the foothills. They named it, you know, I was trying in the book to figure out over a period of years why it's called Wasteland. Yeah. And the neighboring villages have names like Mudtown and the Dunes and Lonely Outpost. And although the villages were all founded in the early 18th century, the closest I could come to why, you know, they have these names is the sort of Greenland-Iceland name reversal, where the people who originally settled these areas didn't want other migrants to come there. They didn't want bandits to stop there. So they gave them these very undesirable names. But in fact, they look nothing like what they're named.
The crop there is rice, as you said, and the development aspect of this story, the corporatization, I guess, comes in the form of a company called Eastern Fortune Rice. Tell me about them and what role they played in the village over the 3 years you were there.
Yeah, I got very lucky in sort of in a way in that I thought I was writing one book and it turned out to be a very different book. I thought I was sort of doing a Pearl Buck, you know, update on the good earth, although without the plagues of frogs and all the biblical suffering. Instead, when I moved there, we had one road in the village, Red Flag Road, and that was doubled in width. And it wasn't the government that was constructing the road. It was this private company called Eastern Fortune Rice. Soon, Eastern Fortune Rice built a hot spring to attract tourists from the cities to come out. And soon, Eastern Fortune Rice started going around household to household and saying, okay, local villagers, wastelanders, you each have about an acre and a half of rice paddy. We will lease your plot of land for a 3-year period. We'll agree on a price right now. We'll pay you a set fee. We'll use mechanized planting, mechanized harvesting. We'll have hired laborers come in and take care of the crop. You don't have to do a thing. And this is a trend. You know, Wasteland was one of the first places to pilot this program, but it's since accelerating in China.
Wasteland is a town of plus or minus 1,400 people. How do they feel about Eastern Fortune coming in and I guess, in essence, taking them off the land?
Yeah, it's really divided right down the middle. I couldn't find a consensus here. And you have elderly farmers who feel like, oh, now we can benefit from our own work and we don't want to give the land to the company. And then you have the younger generation who could not wait to sign up and then allow their farmhouse to be plowed under and planted with rice. And then they would move into a company-built 5-story walk-up apartments they're constructing around the edge of the city.
You ask at one point one of the people in town or one of the people who works for Eastern Fortune, I can't quite remember, what Wasteland will look like in 5 years.
It's the vice president, actually, of Eastern Fortune Rice, and was more than happy to sit down and explain all their success and all their plans for the town. And when I said, what will this place look like in 5 years, he said, you won't even recognize it. And I thought, Starbucks? And he said, he said, no, we're talking, a new expressway. We're talking new schools. We're talking a ski slope, if we can construct that. At one point, I sort of casually remarked that Wasteland's quite a beautiful name. And he said, oh, yeah, but, you know, we want to change it. And I said, to what? And he said, to Eastern Fortune, after the company. Ultimately, no matter how this plays out, rice will still be grown in this region in the next 100 years. I hope it's still in a village named Wasteland.
It's a book by Michael Meyer called In Manchuria about Northeast China. It's a really good read. Michael, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
We've got the first chapter of Michael's book and some pictures from it on our website, marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, which I will freely admit pilfering from the Twitter feed of my colleague David Gura. Perhaps you've seen all those kids sledding on Capitol Hill in Washington today. The federal government and schools there being closed for the day on account of the snow. Did you know that they were technically breaking the law or regulations anyway? It's true. From the Capitol grounds regulations, courtesy of the architect of the Capitol's office, this sentence, no person shall coast or slide a sled within Capitol grounds. Bah humbug. That's all I have to say.
Marketplace is supported by Farmers Insurance, out to educate everybody about common insurance gaps. Learn more at farmers.com/innercircle. Farmers Insurance, know the gaps. And by Allianz, serving more than 83 million customers worldwide and providing retirement solutions through its affiliated companies in the United States. AllianzUSA.com. And by Kronos, helping businesses increase revenue, lower costs, and improve customer satisfaction with cloud-based workforce management solutions. More at Kronos.com. Kronos, workforce innovation that works.
And away we go. Today, the Dow up 38 points, 0.2%. The NASDAQ up 15 points, 0.3%. The S&P 500 climbed 2 points, 0.1%. John Buckley, Deirdre Depke, Nancy Fargali, Patty Hirsch, Cindy Johnston, George Judson, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our managing editor is Mark Miller. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.